Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Hello, everybody. My name is Mike King. I'd like to thank the International Cultic Studies Association for inviting me to present on the Zion Society cult. I'm a retired criminal investigator and a former chief of staff to the Utah Attorney General. During the day, I consult with the world's largest police departments. At night, I sign on to my popular YouTube channel called Profiling Evil. For over a decade, gossip swirled around northern Utah that a secretive group of religious zealots were buying up homes and taking over a developing neighborhood in Ogden's community. The homes were known far and wide for their immaculately landscaped yards, and rumors spread that a well-known landscaper in the city had proclaimed himself to be a prophet of God. While things were gorgeous on the outside, rumblings of disturbing activities behind closed doors are what really kept law enforcement awake at night. The self-proclaimed prophet was a 61-year-old gardener named Arvin Shreve. He was credited with designing and maintaining the award-winning municipal gardens. They surround the police department, the sheriff's office, the jail, the city offices, and the courts. Everyone who was anyone knew who Arvin Shreve was. Publicly, he was a religious zealot and a quiet man who appeared humble and meek. In my investigation, I would discover that in reality, he was a sex pervert and a pedophile who twisted scripture to justify his demented and criminal behavior. His doctrine included claims that he was God's current day prophet on earth and his right-hand man in heaven. He taught that he was the only person who could guarantee eternal life to everybody on earth. He believed in plural marriage. Perhaps he only fantasized about plural marriage, teaching his followers that it was his responsibility to take on multiple wives. If they were smart enough to align with him, he promised them eternal life, but it required that they surrender to his lust. At the time of his arrest, he was spiritually married to 28 women and young girls, all whom he was intimately involved with. His deviant thoughts and fantasies extended way beyond polygamy, and before long, he began teaching his followers that his wives should also begin having sex with each other. Through his ramblings, he convinced the women that this forced lesbianism was the highest form of spirituality they could experience, something that he referred to as sister councils. As this sex addict's perversions intensified, he announced revelation that declared that all of the female children, regardless of age, should become sexually active with each other, the other women in the group, and of course, with Shreve himself. The group functioned in secrecy for more than 5 years, and they grew to more than 120 members who held fast to Shreve's end-of-world ideology. His doctrine included the need to stockpile weapons and become proficient in their use. He taught that the day would come when they would need to defend their compound. Unlike other cults, the Zion Society group chose to build their commune in plain sight, not in some secluded spot. Well, for a while, it seemed to work for them. They amassed 14 homes at the time of the raid, and they were carefully situated in a small neighborhood which had only one way in and one way out. The homes were alarmed and interconnected. Some of the homes served as sentries and security, while another was identified as a medical center. There was a library and a makeshift school, as well as a home that was filled with sewing machines that supported their Sweet Things lingerie business. Then there was the home where the self-proclaimed leader and most of his wives lived. It was conveniently located across the street from the female children's dormitory, affectionately called the Sister Council Home. Next to that stood the home that they used for recruiting new members. Neighbors complained of bizarre after-hours activities, but police would remind them when called that deviant behavior wasn't against the law. At the same time, several ex-husbands complained of custody battles, but never could produce anything criminal. The normal police response when called was to just inform the estranged family member that their case was civil in nature and they needed to pursue it in family court. At the time, I was leading an undercover sting task force that was buying and selling stolen vehicles. I loved that job. I will never forget sitting at my desk in the county attorney's office one morning when the receptionist asked me to come to the lobby to meet with someone. I assumed it was just another snitch who wanted to talk about a chop shop he was selling stolen cars to. Well, as I entered the reception area, I was met by a beautiful young woman in her early 20s. Her hair was stiff with hairspray. She clearly had spent a lot of time getting ready for the day, and as I approached her, she stood to greet me and said, "My name is Aaron Anderson, and I'd like to talk to somebody about a cult that I've been a member of that is sexually abusing children. Can you talk to me?" Well, it was mind-blowing, as you might guess. I'd like you to hear from Aaron as she described the cult on the program A Current Affair with reporter Mike Watkus. Mike and I have remained friends for years, and we chat often. Let's listen in.
I belong to one of three sister councils. I was part of the largest, Arvin's. There's 28 women, girls, females in
that
council.
You say his Arvin's council. You mean these women were his responsibility?
Yes. He had free reign over them to do whatever he wanted.
What does that mean?
Sexually, psychologically, physically.
28 women?
Yes.
He had at his disposal?
Yes.
What is the age range of these 28 women?
The youngest one is 2 years old, and the oldest, I believe, is 59.
This 61-year-old gardener had free reign to do anything he wants, you say, over 28 women ranging in age from 59 to 2?
Yes.
Unbelievable.
They work where he wants them to work. They give him all of their money. They believe that everything he brings to them is straight from God. So you can imagine, once the mind's been twisted, you disobey something Arvin says, then you've got these other sisters saying, you know, what's your problem? You just disobeyed God. You just disobeyed your master.
Well, that launched one of the most incredible and unbelievable investigations of my career. After our explosive interview, I raced to the county attorney's office to share the details. Before our discussion ended, the county attorney ordered me to drop all of my property crimes investigations and pick up the case immediately. There was no arguing about my experience, and I immediately went to work building a team of experts to help me as I dug deeper into the case. During my investigation, I learned of a private investigator who had actually infiltrated the cult and obtained some valuable evidence of the abuses that were going on. Her story of feigning interest in the lingerie business and the cult's attempt at recruiting her are a story all their own. Perhaps we'll explore that someday in a different presentation. But after about a month of round-the-clock investigation, I was successful in getting search warrants for the compound. The stakes were incredibly high as we strategized about the rumors of weapons stockpiles and the defensive training that the cults were participating in. I worked with my old SWAT team commander, and a small team was put together that would actually help us develop a plan. It would require 70 police officers to raid the compound in the early morning hours. We were supported by 4 mental health experts from the Division of Family Services, their job to take the children into protective custody. We notified the officers that we had handpicked for the raid the night before, but we didn't tell them what they were doing. And frankly, they weren't happy about the 4 a.m. briefing call the next morning. We just couldn't risk saying something and having someone tip the cult members to our plans. If anyone knew, we risked a standoff that could result in the loss of life, not to mention the risk of having important evidence destroyed. We held the briefing the following morning at 4 a.m., and as soon as the officers saw the county attorney, the police chief, the command staff, and the SWAT commander, they knew they were taking part in something big. At 6 o'clock in the morning, we hit all of the homes in the Colt simultaneously, and within a few minutes, we had all the occupants in the homes secured. There were no shots fired. There were no physical confrontations. But over the next 7 hours, investigators combed through the evidence and seized what was listed on the warrants. Many of the 32 children in the Colt were taken into protective custody by family services and scooted away to places of safety. They would endure weeks of interviews and, in some cases, interrogations. This self-proclaimed prophet, though, may have been tipped off and he was nowhere to be found, so we posted a nationwide arrest warrant for him. Now, I'd like to show you a little bit of the video that we captured on the day of the raid. Sadly, after 31 years, most of the evidence from the trial has been lost, but I was fortunate to find this video in my personal files at home. Let's watch this. This initial screen is just the entry into one of the homes, but pay close attention. All the walls were carpeted throughout the homes in order to keep things quieter. This sewing area was part of the Sweet Things lingerie business. And pay close attention to just this obsessive compulsive nature of how well things were stacked and put into place. Of course, all of the food storage was perfectly lined up with all the labels facing the same way. Absolutely incredible. Even the towels stacked to the very color in which they were. This was just an indication of the fact that we captured them while they were sleeping and took them into custody. Now we're looking at the food storage area and just home after home filled to the rafters with home storage, filled with prescription medicines. They actually had gone into hospitals and stolen equipment from the hospitals, faking injuries so that they could get access to things to stockpile their medical center within the Colt. This bunker was extremely interesting to us. We could never get a search warrant for it, and we believe that the self-proclaimed leader was actually hiding inside of it during the raid. Again, the judge wouldn't give me a search warrant for this, and when I asked the leader if he hid there, he refused to answer me. So I don't know whether he was or not. This is just an example of the emphasis they put on beds and bedrooms. They tied that to Christianity. And of course, here we can hear this man who became the chief of police showing one of the alarms. And then, of course, the thing that was really frightening were all of the weapons that were hidden in different places. Here's one example, but in one case, the entire carpeting on a floor was pulled up. Here's tithing for Arvin, money that members of the group had given to this self-proclaimed leader. And then here you'll see the Velcro being torn to separate the carpet from hidden caches of semi-automatic weapons. And these were high-capacity magazine weapons, mini 14s and the like. A very, very dangerous weapon. And again, just an example of some of the hiding places and in the way in which they hid them. Here was an area children were hidden when estranged parents would come looking for them. It was very difficult to find those locations until you looked at it from an architectural standpoint. Again, the towels in the bathrooms even perfectly laid out. The dish soap, everything was perfectly clean in all of the homes. All of the homes had bars on the windows to protect from any intruders. Again, another semi-automatic assault rifle in one of the hiding areas. Now, this was really interesting because it gave us an understanding of the way in which they organized the drawers. Again, everything was done in a very orderly fashion, and all things were stacked by colors, including things like women's intimate underwear and other kinds of intimate apparel. So this was really intriguing to see and to be able to understand what was really going on in the minds of this group. this piece of clothing became very important because it was a piece of evidence where a child was used in sexual assaults wearing that piece of clothing. So it kind of gives you an idea of what we had. And sadly, that's the extent of the raid video that we have in our possession. Well, the children began sharing stories of sexual assaults and rapes almost immediately. In this short video, Dr. Kevin Goley at Primary Children's Hospital interviewed this little six-year-old who was raped more than 100 times. Dr. Goley is now deceased, but the child has given me permission to share this portion of her interview. Let's watch.
Who taught about the sexual way?
In the school, they are ready.
Who helped him?
Well, 3 days later, Shreve turned himself in to police some 300 miles away. Another detective and I drove to his location, and after several hours of interrogation, we received a full confession of rapes and sexual assaults.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Kimberly Perkins.
And I'm Phil Reeson. Good afternoon. The leader of Ogden's alleged lesbian polygamist group known as the Zion Society turned himself in to police in Cedar City this morning. Arvin Shreve was the subject of a nationwide manhunt after authorities charged him with child sexual abuse. Our Paul Murphy has been following the story all week and has the latest.
61-year-old Arvin Shreve turned himself into Cedar City police shortly after 8 this morning. Shreve said he had been traveling in Nevada and Arizona when a friend told him there was a warrant out for his arrest.
We spoke with some family members and friends last evening, advised them that if they had an opportunity to contact him, that it would be in his best interest at this point. According to Mr. Shreve, he has talked to friends who were aware of the charges, and that's the reason for turning himself in.
Shreve is the leader of the Zion Society, a secretive group that allegedly formed a religious sect by combining elements of Mormonism, polygamy, and lesbianism. Private investigators infiltrated the group and say they found out that members use lingerie shows to solicit women into the Zion Society. Last Friday, authorities raided 7 of the Society's homes and took 9 children into protective custody. On Tuesday, Shreve was charged with 2 felony counts of child sex abuse. Religious leader is being held on $50,000 bail. Paul Murphy, KTVX, 4 News.
Over the course of the 2 years that followed, 12 defendants wound their way through the court system. All 12 were convicted of sexual crimes against children. But we decided to stop after 2 years because we didn't want to keep going after adults, knowing that we were re-victimizing the children each time they testified. You see, back in the 90s, the child victims were required to testify in preliminary hearings. Defense attorneys were even a little bit aggressive during those hearings, much differently than they would be in a trial because there was no jury to see them doing it.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Randall Carlisle.
And I'm Kimberly Perkins. A bizarre tale of sex in an Ogden courtroom and a grueling ordeal for a young witness. Defense attorneys fired tough questions at a teenage girl today who claims she was sexually abused in Ogden Zion Society. 43-year-old Becky Johnson is charged with aggravated sexual abuse of a child. Court reporter Paul Murphy was at her preliminary hearing today.
According to today's testimony, Becky Johnson was 3rd in charge in the Zion Society and in charge of the religious sect's finances. During cross-examination, Johnson's attorney grilled the young girl who charges Johnson with molesting her.
I didn't consider it tough at all. She hasn't seen anything yet.
Florence wanted the accuser to give exact details about what happened and when it happened. The young witness said it was hard to remember specific acts of sexual abuse because she says she was abused thousands of times by a lot of people and that it happened every day. It just happened and happened and happened, the teenage girl testified. Still, she remembered 2 events with Johnson specifically and at least 25 accounts of abuse in general. The sexual was supposed to be the spiritual, she said, and added that Johnson was often her teacher. Touching was a religious issue, to bond the sisters together. The hearing ended with Johnson bound over for trial, and the accuser's stepmother accusing the defense attorney of victimizing her daughter a second time.
He just was real aggressive, and I felt he was a little ruthless there. She's just a child.
And if Johnson is convicted of sexually assaulting that child, she could serve life.
Well, each time they had to testify, we wondered how much these children could endure. In hindsight, we may have erred in stopping, but we chose to let several defendants off the hook in order to spare the children. The courts required the parents of the victim children to take their little ones to counseling, which was paid for by state victims' reparations. We assumed they would remain in the care of family services, and we patted ourselves on the back for a job well done. Over the years, I would pull out the case information thinking I should write about this story, but it was always too painful, and each time I worked on the manuscript, I would simply tuck it away and think to myself, this story really shouldn't be told. Well, after the Zion Society came to a conclusion, I accepted a position with the Attorney General's office, leading a new task force, the Ritual Crime Task Force. I investigated all of the polygamous groups in the state, and our task force investigated more than 300 cases of ritual crime, which then meant primarily cases where occult and Satanism played a part. In addition to investigating these crimes, our team provided training to investigators on how to handle these kinds of investigations and conduct these kinds of interviews. I was privileged to be trained in behavioral profiling and devoted my postgraduate work to this discipline. I thought you might like to hear from this self-proclaimed prophet who spoke from God about 5 years after he went to prison. Listen in.
Point. We can develop at least enough of a rapport. I'm not asking you to accept my past. I'm just asking you, can we have a rapport as two human beings? And that's what would have solved an awful lot of problems in the past, and you're going to be facing an awful lot of these communities. Maybe one more point. Do we have the time that I can make one brief point? If we see properly the economic situation which is shaping up in the world, we may be in for an economic squeeze in this country before it's over with. And what does that mean in relationship to groups? People tend to band together when you've got economic problems. You think you've got groups now. If this thing tightens, wait till you see what happens. Well, now, are all of these people going to turn into child abusers? Of course not. And if you go out with the attitude of law enforcement that anybody who's banding together as a group have got some skullduggery going on, you may find that you're wasting an awful lot of time. But on the other hand, if you build the barriers or take down the barriers of isolation and build some rapport with these people, talk to them, get to know them. I congratulate you, Mike, on what you're doing with that group in Manti. It is the proper approach. I don't know whether they've got problems or not. I don't suspect anything. But for heaven's sakes, don't isolate them.
Well, in this video, I had Sharif speak to an audience of 500 police investigators about cult dynamics and how law enforcement can better communicate with cult leaders. Time went on, nearly two decades passed, and I retired from law enforcement. In 2019, I received an email from Amber, one of the child victims from the Zion Society case. She asked if I could talk to her about the case and perhaps explore some of the disruptive memories that she was having. I waited for a few days before declining her request. I just didn't want to remember the case, frankly. Well, a week later, I received a separate email from another victim of the abuse case. Her name was Andrea. She, too, was having difficulty with some of her memories and wondered if I could help clear up some questions that she had. Well, like my response to Amber, I sent Andrea a declination. But my decision haunted me for weeks. I found myself tossing and turning at night, wondering what I should do and if I made the right decision. Finally, I decided to reach out to these two women and offer to talk. Well, within weeks, we organized a larger call with many of the survivors of the Zion Society cult, and they taught me what their lives had been like in the last 30 years. In short, they said that the system failed them. It failed them when it required their parents to get them counseling. You see, their parents were members of the cult and supportive of the ideology. It was like a huge light turned on. I was embarrassed that we hadn't thought of it, yet I justified in my mind that it just wasn't my responsibility as a police officer to think that part through. Well, another area that we learned we failed in was that we had this idea of matriculating them back into public school. Most of them failed to return successfully to public schools, and they ended up working hourly wage jobs the rest of their lives, not enjoying the value of an education. I interviewed as many of the victims from the cold as I could and asked the following questions to them, which, while not entirely scientific, gave me a much clearer understanding of some of the dynamics of those who were in the cult. Most of the victims' parents joined the cult out of a sense of spiritual elitism. They had a belief in plural marriage, and they had an ideology, a like-minded way of thinking of this end-of-world belief that the cult leader had. When asked whether the father or mother was the decision maker in the home, 56% of the children said their mothers were the primary influencer and decision maker. 63% of the parents only had a high school education, with 37% having somewhere between 0 and 4 years of college experience. 72% of the parents worked odd jobs or blue-collar jobs, and only 28% of the female children resided with their parents in the cult. 72% either lived in the sister council house, that was the home that taught the forced lesbianism and the assaults by the prophet, or they lived with other cult members. Children would live 2 or 3 houses away from their parents, and yet they would only see them once or twice a year. After the cult was taken down, only 14% of the parents supported any form of mental health counseling. And those 14% only got the counseling when they demanded it, usually at turning age 18. Only 40% of the victims have had any kind of counseling since leaving the cult, but 70% would like to have counseling, simply stating they can't afford it. Of the victims, 29% attended college, while 14% never progressed past the 6th grade. All of the victims expressed difficulty with relationships, and many had not shared their cold experience with their spouse, even at the time of our interview. 86% of the victims felt they were overprotective of their children, and they worry that something similar will happen to their children if they allow them to go out. 72% say this is a serious problem for them. And all of the victim survivors complain of disruptive memories from the abuse that they endured in the cult. You know, during my interviews with the survivors, I interviewed one young woman who was 18 at the time of the raid. In reality, I had her on one of my lists as a predator, but she was one of those people that we never prosecuted. As I spoke with her a few years ago, it became abundantly clear that she was abused for 5 years before she became an adult and the focus of some of my investigation. In reality, she too was a victim of the cult leader. After hearing all of this, I was determined to fix what I could, realizing that we had unknowingly failed these children in so many different ways. My first call was to the original county attorney, Reed Richards. Richards agreed with my assessment that we needed to help, and we placed an action plan into place. Our first call was to the current county attorney, who amended the criminal case that this young woman was named in and reclassified her as a victim. The case had long since passed the statute of limitations, but it was so important to her and to us now that it was changed. It would also directly impact our next cause of action. We then went to the Utah Victims' Rights Coalition. After obtaining support from the governor, we were able to guarantee the victims of the Zion Society free mental health counseling under the Crime Victims Reparations Act. This happened some 30 years later. They were astounded, overcome with emotion, and they felt validated. It was a very special moment, but it was only one part of what was yet to come. We then introduced the survivors to the president of Weber State University, who told them that his staff was poised and ready to help them get an education. He went on to say, whether you pursue a GED or a PhD, we'll help you do it. There wasn't a dry eye in the group, and many of these women have taken advantage of the counseling and the educational opportunities since this was announced.
Over the course of the following year, 12 individuals were charged and found guilty of sexual crimes against children. Arvin Shreve was sent to prison for 20 years to life. Eventually, he died in 2009. I am really looking forward to seeing these kids. It's been 30 years, and there's never been a day that's gone by that I haven't thought about them. No child should have to go through what they went through. And they are the true heroes because they survived and they beat this guy.
Well, former Detective Mike King joined us now. He's the owner of an investigative firm called Profiling Evil and host of the YouTube show of the same name. He's working on a book about his experience, and it's called Profiling Evil, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. So, Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Phil. Wow.
So I know that we have to be socially distanced here, but can y'all all see Mike?
I'm just going to back up a little.
At least step up a little and say hi.
Yeah, I'll say least, hi.
This is punishing to not be able to hug these beautiful girls.
I'm sure the same for them as well. So, Mike, this came across your desk 30 years ago. What did you think when you first read these accounts?
Holy cow, Doc, I was a property crimes investigator. I was running an undercover sting operation, and this incredibly brave woman walked in and to the office and said, do you have a minute to talk to me? I've been involved in a cult that's sexually abusing children. And I tried to act casual, like I hear this every day. Yeah. And that launched us into one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had.
How did this affect you personally?
I was incensed. I don't know how any investigator doesn't associate with things they're experiencing in their own life anyway. I looked at my children who were similar in age. I couldn't imagine that this was even possible, that a parent would do this to a child. It just didn't seem possible, Doc.
After Shreve was caught, arrested, and imprisoned, then people started coming forward, supposedly at his direction.
We were fortunate in getting a full confession from him. The appeal that this would avoid the embarrassment of this going out, the fact that we had physical evidence, we had eyewitness testimony. I mean, we had solid cases against these people. And so for him to say to them, go in and confess, was a way to minimize what might happen in the public eye.
Next. One of the things that I find most impressive is that all five of you have found a way to overcome what has really been developmentally disruptive in your lives. I wrote down some things that each of you said. You know, Amber, you're now an entertainer, stand-up comedian. You say, my life is flourishing. I want to advocate for those that are still in groups like these and for the little girl that I once was. And Dawn, by the time the fifth grade was over, I had a best friend and I liked my teacher, which helped acclimate me. And Natalie, my past has given me a successful writing career. I'm very even-tempered and I handle things as they come. And Anessa, these kind of cults can happen anywhere. I have not told my children what I experienced, but perhaps I will many years from now when the time is right. And Andrea, the transition into the real world was rough, but eventually I learned to have a somewhat normal life. I chose to write my graduating thesis on why people join cults. I really admire all five of you for what you've done.
Thank you.
God bless you all. I want to thank all of my guests for being here today and sharing their stories. By sharing what they went through here today, They're showing other victims of abuse that they are not alone. I also want to give a special thanks to Mike King, who after 30 years helped orchestrate all of these survivors coming together. So thank you very much for that. Listen, don't forget to check out Profiling Evil on YouTube.
You know, it was 30 years too late, but it was the right thing to do in our opinion. The final thing I needed to do was at the victim's request, and that was write a book about the cult and tell their story. That launched the research, writing, and publishing of my book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. It addresses the abuses these brave children faced, but it focuses on cult recruiting techniques and cult behaviors. We have been honored to deliver the proceeds from this book to build a new children's advocacy center and support law enforcement training in sexual abuse. Well, as I wrap up this interview of the Zion Society cult investigation, I'm reminded that some stories are difficult, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't be told. To ignore, avoid, or pretend such events don't occur isn't helpful to victims, potential victims, or to society in general. Awareness is the first step to healing and protecting victims and ultimately bringing perpetrators to justice. My hope is that this, in some small way, brings some justice to the children who were victimized in the Zion Society cult. Thank you. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.